If you have questions about digital photography, you've come to the right place. Welcome to Photo Focus. Here's your host, Scott Bourne.
Welcome to the 100th episode of the Photo Focus podcast. So glad you could join us on this momentous event. Yes, we've been here 100 shows, and sometimes it feels like 10,000, but it's only 100. And to celebrate this occasion, I asked one of my good friends from long ago, back in the early days of photography podcasting, Mr. Frederick Van Johnson is with us today. Hi, Frederick.
Hey, Scott. You make me feel old.
Well, I did notice two gray hairs on your head this weekend in Vegas.
Yeah, right in the same spot, too.
They're like right in the front.
I love it. I love it. I want to get like my dad. My dad has a gray, a white, a, like a black and white beard going. I want to get that.
For those of you that may not be familiar, he's not at all like me, folks. He'll never tell you any of his accomplishments. But Frederick is a real photographer, combat photographer from the Air Force. Literally, I mean, he is not celebrated as a photographer because he doesn't talk about his photography enough, in my opinion. One of the best photographers I know. And we've gone out and shot together. We went and did a couple of – we did a workshop with Apple and Aperture and all that together. He's a great guy. We did TWIP together. I'm trying to remember all the places you've worked. You've worked at Adobe because you had the cool office that I went up to see you in where the airplane came right at us.
Yeah. Adobe. I've worked at – so at Adobe, I was the marketing manager for a little application called Lightroom.
A little one.
And I managed the professional photography market segment. So I got to know a lot of really good people in that job that you can imagine.
Yeah.
At Apple, I managed the consumer photography area, which at that time was iPhoto and increasingly becoming iPhoto and Aperture. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so that's what I did at Apple. And then, you know, I kind of started in Silicon Valley at Yahoo. So I was managing Yahoo computers at the time. That's when they were – Yahoo was saying, hey, we're going to eat CNET's lunch. And all we're going to do is build a, you know, a vertical around it. And it didn't happen.
So. So the first week CNET was open, I went and visited it. I took a tour of it with a man named Halsey Miner. Did you ever know Halsey?
I know who he is, but I don't know him personally.
The original founder.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the only other person who's still at CNET, I think, was Brian. He was there then.
Brian Cooley?
Yeah. He ran the audio side for them.
Yeah.
And we were like old radio guys talking. But that was – I don't even remember where it was. It was over there somewhere near, you know – Pier 39, someplace odd. And that's bringing back the old times, Frederick. Well, anyway, Frederick's pedigree is well established. Today we're going to start the show the way we've been doing the last couple of episodes. We're just going to talk about photo stuff in general, then we'll get to a couple of user questions. I do want to say before we go any further, though, that this show is possible today because of my friends in BorrowLenses.com. It doesn't matter whether you need a lens or a camera, by the way. Tripods, recorders, microphones, they've branched out to anything that works pretty much for audio, video, photography that's related to the work we do with these cameras. And they carry every brand. If they don't have the lens, you don't need it. They're very affordably priced. You can click on the BorrowLenses.com banner on the Photo Focus site, or just type BorrowLenses.com into your URL. We appreciate their support of Photo Focus. Frederick, let's talk about a sad event for me anyway. Kodak filed for bankruptcy.
Yeah, that was sad. You know, and that came just, what was it, mid last week, I think,
came
in.
Yeah, last week.
And it was, you know, for me, both of us, Scott, we started in photography when there was this thing called film, right?
So yeah, back in the 1850s.
Yeah, and I think, you know, back then, just to like wax poetic a little bit, back then it was like part of the division between professionals and amateur photographers was the kind of film you used, right?
That's
correct. It was like, you shooting black and white, or are you shooting color? Like, if you're color, you're probably amateur, whatever, you know. You're shooting black and white, you're an artist, and if you're shooting color slide film, then you're a professional, right?
Because of the
exposure latitude on slide film was like plus or minus a third of a stop. So you're like, okay, he's shooting slide film, and some publications only took transparencies, you know, as the submission. So, yeah, and then all of that was Kodak. I mean, Kodak was like the bedrock of this industry. It's almost like Kodak going away is almost like saying, like, Sony is going away. You know, it's like, okay, all these things that have been part of your life forever, the company that created them somehow couldn't manage to get it together to make it work, and now they're going away, which is very sad.
Yeah, I tell you what, they did so much for our industry. If you were a professional photographer, let's say 80s and 90s, it was Kodak that sponsored everything. I mean, now it's Adobe or somebody like that. But back then, man, it was Kodak everything. If you went to a conference, it was Kodak that made it possible. If there was anything going on, any contest, it was Kodak. They really were hooked in to a different kind of social network than we have today.
Yeah.
And they had reps. And my rep's name was Mike. He called on my studio all the time. Probably one of the nicest human beings I've ever met. Yeah. And he was the most creative guy. And he'd come in one day and he's like, I got an idea. It's going to make you $1 million. And he had this plan. If you just shoot this many rolls of film, do this many sessions, it's guaranteed. I've done all the numbers. You'll make $1 million. And I was like, Mike, I don't want to take a pay cut. But it's nice to see
that's a Scott Bourne-ism right there.
I was already making $1 million and I was not shooting 200 sessions a week to get it. But of course, Kodak wanted you to shoot 200 sessions a week and charge less money so that you could do more sessions so that they could sell you more film. But it was anyway, it was I'll just never forget when you take a roll of Kodak film through a good old Hasselblad 503CW and you get that big old 2.25 negative and make a nice print. It was great. But then things changed. You know, mid 90s, I got the first. I think it was the DCS, which stood for Digital Camera Systems, as I recall.
Yeah.
The 420. 25.
That's what we had. That's a good story, Scott, because when I was in the Air Force, my unit at Vandenberg Air Force Base received the first DCS 420s. We got like a crate of them. I don't know. Maybe not a crate, but like 20 of them, I think, for a group of 10 photojournalists. And as you remember, these were big old honking things with hard drives in them.
They were huge. They were like, okay, this is not an exaggeration. Take three 5D Mark IIs, stack them above each other, and that's how tall this thing was.
Yeah.
Shot 1.5 megapixels.
Yep.
But what was really cool about it at the time was it did 2 frames a second, and ready for this? A 5-shot burst.
Yeah. And then and you'd use up your entire battery on that 5-shot burst. Yeah. So our group at Vandenberg is the AVS, the Audio Visual Service Group, Combat Camera. So we got these things in, and we're playing with them. Like, wow, this is great. And this is back in the Photoshop 2 days, right?
Right.
It's like, wow, this is great. This is awesome. This is the future. I know it is, you know, but it still wasn't anywhere near the resolution of film. So everyone was like, yeah, whatever, you know. So we're out shooting and playing with it. And where it became obvious that this was the future is when we go on these deployments, you know, these exercises, not real deployments. But we go out on these exercises. I remember we went out to the backwoods of Colorado once. And we had the portable satellite dish where you pop this thing out. It's in this big case. It looked like a big suitcase. And unwrap the antenna and set it up in the middle of nowhere and find the satellite, and then boom, after about 15 minutes you'd have a phone, you know, so you could actually make phone calls, and which meant you could actually connect a modem to it and transmit images to the Pentagon. So we were like, what? Now we can go out here and shoot and upload and not have to go back and develop and screen and all that. So we had set up our little mini tent city. We had generators and all that. Inside the tent city, we'd have these tables, or inside the tent, we'd have these tables with Macs set up on the tables. And then the satellite thing outside, you know, that we could just plug into and transmit. And our computers were these, we had Macs on the tables in there. And then outside, you know, for running around and stuff, we had the you remember those old portable Macintoshes, the gray ones with the trackball on them?
I do indeed, yeah.
We had those, the black and white ones.
I can't remember the model number, but yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, because they had the black and white ones with the little screen, and then finally they got color, right? So, and then we got the color ones, and it was you know, it was good. We thought the revelation was, holy crap, we can shoot this stuff and screen it and make it, you know, little changes in Photoshop and then upload our little 1.5 megapixel images directly to the Pentagon, and everybody's all good, you know. But now, at your iPhone, Scott, it can do all that and more.
Yeah, right now our audience is going, well, why didn't they just use Flickr?
Yeah, like, exactly. Yeah, like, there was no internet.
There was no Wi-Fi. There was no Flickr. And every time I have this conversation with one of my young staff, they'll come back and they'll say, well, couldn't you use Facebook? And then they'll go back for an hour, and then they'll come back. Well, what about – they just cannot get their arms around the notion that we did the things we did and how primitive it was. Like a modem, I do not have a staffer who's ever used one.
Oh, wow.
That stands for modulator.
I'm thinking about finding that screech tone, you know, when you dial up the modem. And, I want to make that my ringtone on the iPhone.
The modulator demodulator.
Exactly.
We had 300 baud, then we had 1200 baud, then we went all the way to 9600 baud. We were cooking with gas. And this here's the thing about this. It's fun to reminisce about this camera compared to what we have today. Taking the cheapest point and shoot you can buy turns the DCS-420 into a piece of crap. Yeah, but it was revolutionary at the time. Now what I did was bought an iris printer.
The iris. Yeah, I remember those. The coveted Sheetal printer. And you paid about $500,000 for it, right?
No, I think they were only $150.
Oh.
I mean, we might have bought them used. Anyway, I bought
$150 1980 prices. This is about
$500. Now, here's the fun part. They're just exactly like helicopters, Frederick. So you know what I'm about to say. You got to have two to make one work.
That's right. One for parts.
Because one's for parts. So I had two of these bad boys, and you can make, wait for it, three prints a day.
Wow.
Because you'd make a print, and then you'd take 8 hours to field strip the son of a gun. And then you'd make another print and another 8 hours.
Yeah, so, not to mention color correction and all that.
And right? It's like, boy, if you messed up one of those prints, I was mad. and it cost, I think our amortized hard cost per print was like $400 or $500. So it was, but we didn't care. It was cool. Now Tektronix came out with the Phaser 450, the first die sub big printer, and it made prints that lasted 6 whole months. And it was only $80,000, so I bought a bunch of those. Of course, then we started realizing that we're going to have to make everybody's prints for them every 6 months. Yeah. Anyway, all this stuff, I'm sorry. We're going to get hate mail for going down old-fashioned lane because the youngsters don't like it. But I will say, here's what's relevant about this. In the mid-90s, I had some meetings with some Kodak execs. I think I'm going to write about this on PhotoFocus the next couple of days. And it was clear to me that they were kind of like grudgingly showing me this camera. Because the big bosses, the ones that controlled the raises and the bonuses and sent them out on the fancy junkets, were in charge of film.
Mm.
And those guys were like, yeah, well, this thing may go somewhere, but we're a film company. Mm. And this isn't as good as film and never will be and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no. I think you're making a mistake. Yeah. And here's the shocking news. You remember who the partner was with Kodak to make this camera, right?
Nikon.
Nikon. Yeah. So here's the decision point that I believe started the beginning of the end of Kodak, and it goes all the way back to 1999, which I am sorry to say is like 13 years ago, but seems like 13 minutes ago to me. They decided not to make their own digital camera body.
Mm.
And Nikon made theirs. And Kodak got left in the dust with just the sensors and the patent portfolio, and that was that.
Didn't they try to, though? They made this crappy quick take. Remember that thing? It looked like a binocular or something.
Well, I'm talking about a serious DSLR.
Yeah. Right,
they did. Right. They made a conscious decision not to do it because, in my opinion, now some people from Kodak will call me and say, no, that's not the reason, but I won't believe it. In my opinion, they made that decision because it scared the film guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, during those times, you could go to Glazer's. I was living in Seattle. You go to Glazer's, which was the big camera store in the Northwest, and there was like a whole area for darkroom stuff and film and paper. In fact, there was a whole refrigerated room the size of most camera stores for film. And then over the years, you know, that got moved out of its own building into just a section of the main building, and then it got moved in from a section to like a couple of aisles, and now there's like 1 4-foot by 4-foot table with one Bresler used and larger on it. That's the film department at Glazer's.
Yeah, grief. Yeah, it sounds like what you're describing is, and I've seen this, you know, having worked at those large companies, is internal factions pulling exactly against each other, and who the loser is the consumer. You know, I saw it at Adobe with, you know, Lightroom versus Photoshop. You see it at, you know, all companies. You know, there's these internal people that have their own agendas, and they want to protect that regardless of if it makes sense or not. So, and it looks like Kodak might be a case study in how that will just torpedo the whole company over time.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate because, you know, they were such a great company. They made, you know, they photography is photography, in my opinion, because of Kodak. I don't think that's too bold a statement. Sure, there was Fujifilm. I even used Velvia all the time when I was doing landscape work. But when it came to portraits, you know, and technical work, Kodak was king. And, you know, it just – even as old as I am and as long as digital's been around, I have still spent more of my career going into a wet dark room and making prints than I have doing it with Aperture or Photoshop.
Yeah. So, Scott, what do you think? You know, having the breadth of experience that you have had with Kodak and these current companies, what do you think would have saved Kodak? Would it have been a merger with Adobe to fight the onslaught of like Apple and others, or what? What could they have done?
What they could have done is, because at the time they dwarfed Nikon, was to say, here's the way this is going to work. We're going to make the camera bodies. We'll let you put your name on them. We're going to OEM them, and we're going to make this and control this and blah, blah, blah. And they went and made a calculated risk to just stick with the sensor side. And, you know, they lost their brand identity, basically. They were no longer the big player. And this gave others a chance to go in. So I really think the mistake was not making their own branded digital SLR and taking that existing relationship. And the reason I brought this up is this all now ties very nicely together, thanks to your question, mm-hmm. is remember my buddy Mike. They had this existing relationship with all these reps all over the country calling on right. all the professional photographers that were actually not wannabes on the internet, but guys selling pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And they already had the relationship. They could have just as easily said, okay, hi, Scott. Mike here. I'm coming over to bring the new digital stuff, and just transitioned that to be your digital rep. And back then, of course, we didn't have a lot of experience with it, so there would have been a lot of hand-holding necessary. They could have for a long time just got that relationship going. Then all the big studios that do a lot of production work would have gotten their hands on these Kodak cameras. They would have been ingrained in that infrastructure, and they would have stuck with it, just like we all watched CBS for the longest time because it was the first television station. They would have had a lot longer to build up, and then they would have had to cut the film. And as you just so aptly pointed out, I think it's a huge business mistake when these big companies, for sport almost, but some guy thinks this managerial style works, will put Division A against Division B mm-hmm. in his own company. And then he'll say, whichever one wins, that's what we'll go with. But as you say, that's not the way. The way to do it is say, what would the customer win look like?
Right.
And let's get right. everybody rowing the boat that way. We signed the checks for both Division A and Division B, so let's get everything going. I think that's what they should have done.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean there's pluses and minuses of both of that. Like, you know, that very same management methodology is what Steve put in place with the Macintosh team, you know, so creating this elite team inside of Apple that is doing their own thing and kind of elitist with regard to the rest of the company, and then they birth these really cool things. It's cool to be part of that team, you know, so in some cases, I mean, I wasn't there, you know, during that, but in right. some cases, based on the computer that I'm looking at right now, that could work.
Right? Well, but here's where I think that's a close analogy, I agree. Mm-hmm. But I think it's slightly different because I believe Kodak was literally doing a civil war. There's a difference between being in, you know, the skunk works at Apple, getting to make cool stuff, and saying, Division A, your bonuses are tied to whether or not you can beat Division B.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think that's what I'm talking about.
Controlled anarchy versus just uncontrolled
right.
craziness.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that was the problem. And then, you know, a lot of miscues on the consumer side, of course. And then it continued. I mean, I just a couple of years ago at WPPI, I met a guy whose name is Scott, who's like the last guy pushing film for Kodak, wandering around looking for any pro photographers that were still shooting film. He said, you know, I listen to Photo Focus. Is there anybody in your audience still shooting film? Give him my number. It was like all.
I remember.
Of you guys
yeah, I remember one of these trade shows I went to. I think Kodak was there giving away film as kind of like, it's kind of like a nostalgia thing. Like, and you know, I got one. I'm like, wow, roll the film. This is cool.
Yeah, know? It's a keychain.
Yeah, I haven't seen one of these in years. Let me carbon date it. You know.
Well, you know, here's the difference. It's like I spoke on behalf of Kodak at WPPI 2 years ago.
Yeah,
I was there. Keynote speaker at their evening dinner they do every year, and
they did every year. Yeah,
you know what the conversation was about. What I was talking about.
What
their version of the flip camera.
Oh,
that's their big deal. Was hey, we got this little camera that's going to be better than the flip.
Is that the ZI-8? Was that the
yeah?
The cam-
it was, you know, again. Yeah. Back to Kodak's marketing problems, the XYZ DCS 1943/5.
Instead of naming it Bob.
Yeah. Right? This is Bob with a friendly camera.
Yeah, coming in 2012.
And
the
they,
Bob,
and they right? were getting a lot of the social media stuff right. Their Twitter person is great, and they were doing a lot. But I just think, you know, that was all operating under this incredibly heavy load. mm-hmm. of all this antiquated. I mean, there's nobody on the Kodak board of directors that isn't 283 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
well, wait, Scott, you know, as I think through this, and I don't know. Maybe you know this, but I don't know what bankruptcy chapter they filed under. Did they file to dissolve the company, or did they file for protection against creditors so they could reorder?
It's protection.
So they're not going away then. They're just trying to get their crap together. Right?
Let's put it like this. You know, that's everybody's first step.
Oh, gotcha.
You know, let's see if anybody cares about – the only thing they have of value, frankly, is their name and their patent portfolio.
I was going to say that patent portfolio has got to be gold. Yeah.
But looking at that now let's take that asset and balance it against their deficits. I'm kind of looking at the last annual report I saw. I'm thinking that's about a 3-to-1. So that patent portfolio takes care of 33% of their debt. Now what?
Yeah.
So I think it'll end up being a wash, and maybe they'll be left over like Ilford, who ended up just selling their name to this other company to make the paper. Mm-hmm. It's no longer Ilford. Remember when Ilford made paper and film?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's what we used. For black and white, it was all Ilford. Yeah. For color, it was all Kodak.
So Ilford then ended up, you know, going away. They sold the name to another company. So there's another company not in any way connected who just bought – it's sort of like when you go to the casinos and they say, you know, be sure to see this night's concert by the Monkees. And there's like a bunch of guys who are not the Monkees but who are the new Monkees.
Yeah, right.
You know
what
I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And so that's probably what's going to happen. I don't say any of this, even though it may sound like it, because I'm my usual direct self. I'm not happy about this. I'd love to see Kodak succeed. I believe my success in my photographic career is in some part due to them.
Yeah.
I mean, I think anybody who's our age, well, your age and then older version me, and above, if they're not willing to, you know, hat tip Kodak, they're pretty arrogant.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I just keep scratching my head of, like, what could they have done? I mean, it's easy to be armchair quarterback and say, you know, they could have done this, you know. But from my layman's perch, you know, what would I have liked to have seen? And I keep thinking, like, couldn't they have just, like, done something with Adobe or Apple, or
could have
gone down the road of Red. I mean, look at Red came out of nowhere and built these insane cameras. Kodak, I mean, physics are physics, right? Kodak had access to the same physics that Red did, you know, presumably more assets and a larger patent portfolio. So how come they didn't jump into the high-end motion picture space deeper and own that or something rather than just throwing up the white flag?
You know what would have really saved them?
What's up?
If they had invented either the Canon 1DX or the Nikon D4.
Yeah.
Which is what we're going to talk about next.
Yes.
That
might have saved them, but, you know, there's that whole momentum thing, too.
Yeah. Before we do that, I am going to say hi and thanks to my good friends at Animoto. Go to Animoto.com. If you have never seen an Animoto slideshow, then guess what, Bubba? You ain't seen a slideshow, because the Animoto slideshows are cooler and neater and wizardry kind of level stuff. They have music and animations and all this stuff. It's now available in high def. You just basically pay a fee, a monthly fee or a yearly fee, and then you make as many as you want. And if you go with their pro service, which is very affordable, you can probably make it back on your first job. You get to do it without branding and make DVDs for people. And the other end of the spectrum is, for absolutely free, you can make videos just to try it out. It's over at Animoto.com. You can click on that little banner on the PhotoFocus.com homepage, or just type in Animoto.com. We appreciate their support of PhotoFocus. Real quickly, I do want to mention to you that PhotoFocus.com is the place to go if you want further photography news, reviews, and tidbits, all kinds of how-tos, tutorials, etc., because we publish there every single day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, PhotoFocus.com. So, Frederick, lots of buzz out on the interwebs about the new D4 from Nikon, Canon 1DX, and then a couple of recent sightings of what people think is the new 5D Mark III. I've had 200 people email me this thing today that came off of some other guy's website, where he was in Africa and there was a guy from Canon shooting with him, and he had a camera he had never seen before, and he took lots of pictures of it, and he surmised it's the 5D Mark III.
Yeah.
But we know the 1DX and the D4 are coming. These are the big behemoths. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, they're not revolutionary, but they're evolutionary. Mm-hmm. One place that's kind of revolutionary is they're both anywhere from 20 to 30% more expensive than the cameras they replace.
Right.
Does this seem like a lot of money to me? I mean, to you? I mean,
I was looking at this, and I have it up. I have the DP review thing of this up now, and I'm looking at it. And when I first saw and I first heard about it, I was like, you know, the first knee jerk reaction to any shooter of any kind of camera that's any kind of geek was want. You know, I need want, and then followed by need with some random justification of why I need to have this body. And you're right. I think looking at the specs, it's a solid evolution of the D3. What is it? What's the latest one? X, you know, and it's a beautiful camera. It's got, you know, finally they're doing video great, you know, on it. It's got 1080p HD video with 24 megabytes per second. Scott,
you have the video. I can't remember all. I'll tell you what, the video is a huge step up.
But what's the one thing that I was kind of, I'm still scratching my head about, and maybe it's just because I don't have one, is the XQD.
Yeah.
Format that they're jumping into.
So they've got this new high-speed card format. The camera comes with two card slots, a traditional CF, and then this new high-speed format that one of the inventors of just said they're not going to support.
Wow, so, nice. We have this brand new sized wheel, but it's not supported.
But the reason it's in there, Frederick, is on the video side, it makes possible to do some very high-speed transfer.
Yeah.
Now, the camera, I'll just say this. There's long been kind of these positions in the hierarchy that the Canons were better at video. Mm-hmm. The Nikons were about a stop better at low light. The sound you just heard was every Canon fanboy in the world sending me a hate email because I said something like that about the low light. But it's the truth. I own the cameras, every single one of them. I got 5 D3Ss, I've got 5 1D Mark IVs, and I've shot both of these cameras. The Canon is still a stop behind the Nikon when it comes to low light performance. Send me all the hate mail you want. It won't change the fact that the world is round.
Yeah, yeah.
Canon is still a skosh better on the video, and here's why. There's some still very weird stuff in the Nikon video that I would recommend people go to somebody like Alex Lindsay or Stu Mashewitz or one of those brainiac guys on the video side to get the details of. But it's still using some weird codec that somehow makes the fact that it's high def not high def. And the video people don't like it. That's, you know, and they're very sticky about things like this. Now, to the average person, let me tell you, they're not going to notice. The video is gorgeous.
I know. Well, speaking of that, just to put things in perspective with the quality of video that's coming out of Canon side and the Nikon side, you know, you rewind back a few years and you look at remember that film that Vincent Laferrere put out?
Absolutely. It was called Reverie.
Revelry, yeah. And I interviewed Vincent again a few weeks ago, and we sort of reminisced about back in the day when he put that together. And you rewatch that video, it's stunning, you know, back with that camera, you know. Yeah,
listen, if you gave Vincent Laferrere a $250 point-and-shoot with a movie mode, he can make an Oscar-winning movie with it because he's Vincent freaking Laferrere, Pulitzer Prize winner. And that's why all these discussions are sometimes just a waste of time because, you know, I have purchased the same golf clubs as Tiger Woods and cannot hit 300-yard drives. I bought that pen that Shakespeare used to write those plays, still can't win any Tonys or any awards. My piano came from the same store where Mozart got his, and my piano playing still sucks.
Yeah, that's true. You know, any in art, you're only as good as what you are. The tool is just a way for you to get your vision out and execute on the skill set that you have and all that. But that said, like you alluded to earlier, Scott, the light sensitivity of this thing is a key factor in allowing you to execute on that vision. What I was saying with the older cameras, and was what I preach all the time about how it's not the gear, right? It's you and your mastery of light, physics, exposure, composition, and the fundamentals of photography that allow you to do something insanely cool. And if you have a mastery of that stuff, you're like Vincent Laferrere, you can go out and create some crazy, you know, award-winning video with a Canon G9. You know, it doesn't matter what
You had to sneak in the promo for the G9 that you're still shooting that you bought in 1963.
I love my G9. One day I'm going to auction it off. I love that camera. It's still a tank. You know?
Let's put it like this. I've purchased every high-end Canon and Nikon camera since 1995.
Yeah.
I can tell you this. They just get better and better and better. They are better than 99.9999% of the photographers who will own either one.
Well, and Scott, let me ask you this. Let me take you out of the alternate dimension into this dimension where money is a factor.
$6,800 bucks for the 1DX is a whole bunch of money. It's crazy money. And if I were just starting out, that $800 price difference would push me to the Nikon no matter what.
No, but I'm saying if you have a current Nikon, say this is a selfish question coming from me, right? So I've got a Nikon D3. You know, it's not even a D3S X or whatever. It's the original D3, which has been sitting right next to my G9, actually, because I don't shoot it. So I shoot with my D7000, and sometimes if I want full frame, I'll use the D700. But 9 times out of 10, if I'm shooting DSLR, it's going to be on the D7000. If I'm not, it's on the iPhone, right? So if it's me and you're advising me as your friend to on this camera, the D4, should I plunk down the cash to get this?
Okay.
Knowing that, you know, it's not, you know, I can get one, but
right.
Should I? It's so not painless, it's like it is for you.
Here's the thing. It would depend on what you're going to shoot. Yeah. If you were really going to step up to video, Frederick, and you decided, you know, I'm just getting so many requests for video, I got to do it, then this camera's worth a look. And if you're a professional, you know, wildlife photographer like me, or you shoot a lot of sports,
yeah,
that high frame rate with a buffer that never ends, that's worth a look. But it is strictly an evolutionary camera, and I'm pretty sure that, you know, other than those particular reasons, there's nobody that really needs this thing. I mean, if you've got a D3, I have a D3Ss, but even if – I think we have one D3 left around here. I mean, that camera's fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, I could shoot that camera for 10 years and still it'd be fine. It's just for situations like when, you know, like I'm at Bosque del Apache and I'm trying to photograph several flocks of birds flying out of a pond. Having these huge buffers would be great.
Yeah.
The video being much better on the D4, that'd be great. The other reason to consider it is that if you want to take pictures of black cats in black barns at night, you can do it with this camera.
Yeah.
I have a picture that I have seen with my own eyes taking it, like, what is it, 125,000 ISO? It's freaking amazing.
12,500, yeah.
No.
Oh, 125.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
I mean, it's like up there in the – like there's ground control in Mars and you know, it's in the insane level. This thing is – there are a lot of people listening to us that practice the religion of low light.
Yeah.
That's all they care about.
I love that, the religion of low light.
Oh, yeah, and
well,
remember –
from the spec sheet from Nikon, yeah. the ISO range of the D4 is 100 to 12,800, but it's extendable, like you're saying, Scott, to 50. You can go down as low as 50 and to as high as 204,800.
That's what I'm talking about.
Insane. I mean, so that's like seeing the alternate dimensions.
Yeah. Well, let me put it like this. I shot ISO 3200 color film back in the days that was unusable.
Yeah.
You couldn't print any of it. It was so bad. So
it's like art. It's a mosaic. Right?
Yeah. It was like, you know, it was like a little 5-year-old punch a bunch of dots on a piece of paper with colored pencils, and that's as close as you're going to get. This camera's low light performance is off the hook, and if you are of the religion of low light and you are one of the priests of the religion of low light, you're going to want to spend the $6,000 bucks on this one. Now, you know, we always go through religions. You know, in the old days, it was megapixels. People had to have the most megapixels. And, you know, now it's low light. And virtually nobody needs cameras that shoot in this low a light. But lots of people like to brag, I've got this one that does. Yeah. On the other side of the coin, if you're asking me this question about the 1DX, I actually see, you know, this camera as less of a need for somebody. If you have the 1D Mark IV.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's less reason to upgrade to the 1DX because you've already got great video, and all you're really getting out of this is like that, you know, a little bit better low light and the buffer speed and all that kind of stuff. I'd say the D4 is a little teeny bit less incremental because it had the video ad, but there's a whole bunch of people listening to us that don't care.
Yeah, but there's another aspect to this that we didn't touch on that could be the reason why you absolutely positively have to have this camera, Scott.
Tell me.
that's if you are one of those photographers that goes to places like WPPI or say Photoshop World, and you want to walk around with a camera around your neck with the D4 logo on it to make everybody else think you're a real photographer.
Pick up chicks, huh?
pick up chicks who know what the D4 means. Yeah. You know?
You probably don't actually want to go out with most of them, just saying. But I'm just joking. It was a joke.
Send your hate mail to Scott.
It was a joke.
No, but yeah, if you wanna like have the photographer bling, this is like the ultimate Nikon photographer bling of the moment, right?
It is the absolute ultimate. These cameras are great. They continue to be great. The good news, Frederick, is there are no bad cameras anymore. That's the best. People tell me on the which one I should buy. I'm like, you know, put a blindfold on, throw a dart. You're going to get a great camera. These cameras are better than the photographers, and they always will be from here on out. I'm going to pick this up in a second, but I do want to briefly mention ViewBug. I don't know if you've checked this out yet, Frederick. ViewBug is the place to go if you want to be involved with photo contests. You want to enter photo contests. You want to judge photo contests. You just want to see a bunch of new pictures. ViewBug.com is probably my favorite new site for this. It is an amazing community. It's sort of been under the radar, but wow, it's just I really highly recommend people try it out. ViewBug.com. There's a banner on the PhotoFocus.com homepage, or just type in ViewBug, ViewBug.com. We appreciate their support of Photo Focus. And I also have to briefly mention my friends and yours, Frederick, Smug Mug, the place to go for professional photo sharing. If you are trying to sell your pictures online, I happen to think this is the best place to do it. They are always improving. Their downtime is almost nothing. They're freaks about maintaining their infrastructure. And I say it every show, and I'm going to keep saying it as long as they're a sponsor, because it's true. We hosted our video with them 3 years before they were a sponsor, because their video hosting is the best in the business. The terms of service are fair, and the quality is not even close. It's better than YouTube. It's better than Vimeo. It's better than anybody's video, because they don't compress it.
Yeah. I agree. Smug Mug, I can't even remember when it was when I first was exposed to Smug Mug and, you know, fell in love with the service back then. And it's amazing that they still fill a niche that no one else can touch. I mean, people like to compare Smug Mug to Flickr because photo sharing and all that, but it's not that. You know, like you said, Scott, Smug Mug for me is a place, and it's different for depending on what your needs are, but for me, Smug Mug is a place where I can build a gallery for, say, some event that I shot. Say it's a model or something. I can build her own gallery with her own price list. You know, and then, oh, this other model right here probably has more money. I can give her a different price list.
Yeah, the price list feature is awesome. Anyway, check it out at smugmug.com. It's infinitely configurable. We appreciate their support of Photo Focus. We're going to take a quick question here, Frederick, from Terrell Woods in Malibu, California. Terrell's asking about the Canon 1-400 push-pull zoom. Have you ever seen that lens?
1-400? No, I haven't.
So here's the thing. This is a really old lens. This lens has been around forever. I mean, this lens is one of the first big zooms Canon sold, and instead of twisting the ring to zoom like you're used to, you push and pull it sort of like, you know, a Uga gun.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, absolutely.
So Terrell's asking, you know, why is this so controversial? I haven't seen this lens, but everyone says there's some problems with it. And the problem is, well, first of all, it's just older technology. It's not going to be tack sharp through the zoom range like the newer zooms will be. But the biggest problem is with the push-pull mechanism is every single time you push and pull that thing, you're bringing dust into the camera.
Yeah.
And you better have yourself one of those really high-end dust sensor cleaning kits.
So it's like a little vacuum in there that's sucking in the outside environment, right?
We used to call them Ooga guns when I was a kid. You'd pump on these things and shoot these Nerf balls with them, and that's the mechanism. It's like a pump action shotgun. So you pump this thing and it just brings every particle and particulate in the air right into your camera. Now, in the right hands, again, this lens will make stellar images. I've sold images using this lens. It wouldn't be my personal choice. I'd rather see a 70-200 with the new 1.4 Mark III teleconverter. I think that's a better combo. But it's all you got the money for. But the best news is you can go to a place like borrowlenses.com, rent it without being committed to it.
Yeah.
And you can figure out if you're going to work it out.
Yeah.
Now, here's a question I wanted you to be on the show for, Frederick, so I actually saved it for this episode. John Hergenhan, I hope I said that right, said, he's trying to figure out the focal length of his zoom lenses because he wants to recreate a shot. Mm-hmm. But he's having trouble figuring out using the EXIF data. Like, is his 70 to 200 is at 191 millimeters? He wants to know that. What's your best advice on how to do that?
He wants to figure out. I want to make sure I understand the question right. So he's got a zoom lens. He wants to know if he's shooting a particular shot, what focal length he was at when he shot that.
Yeah, image? So it's a zoom lens, and he knows it was somewhere, let's say, between 70 and 200, but he's trying to figure out, was it at like exactly 74 millimeters, or was it exactly 103 millimeters?
Yeah, well, that's in the EXIF data. That will be.
He's saying he can't find it. Is it hard to get to? I'm thinking what he's done wrong is you have to go into your preferences and turn on all that stuff so that it shows up, and you can choose what shows up in your EXIF data, right?
Yeah, you can. Now, you may have said this, but which application is he using? Is he using Lightroom?
He didn't say.
So that matters, right? So on Lightroom, if he clicks on the image off to the right there in the inspector, it's going to tell you. You don't have to turn it on. It's going to tell you down below. I'm trying to open this catalog right now so I can find it. But it will tell you, and maybe you can mention this later, Scott, but it'll tell you right down below exactly what focal length you were at. It's part of the EXIF data, and I actually have it up now. So it is lens. Yeah, right here. So yeah, I just launched Lightroom. I'm looking to the right on the bottom. I am in the library view. I have an image selected. It's in full screen. On the right, under metadata, down at the bottom, it's got my dimensions, it's got my exposure, and it's got focal length. And it also tells me what lens I was using. In this case, I was shooting an image with a 70 to 200 2.8 lens, and it tells me the focal length when I pressed the shutter on this image was 95 millimeters. So it's right there. You don't have to turn anything on. Just look to the right and look down. And that's in Lightroom 3. It's the same in Lightroom 4 beta. But I would suggest, in the aperture, I'm sure there's something very similar to that. So just look for it. Point is, it records that data at the time that the shutter was pressed.
Yeah, I think where you turn it on and off might be in some of the programs I've used, like some of the Windows programs, now that I think of it, that I've been testing for people. But the data is there. You got to just figure out, depending on which program you're using, how to find it. And he could be using perhaps like Elements or iPhoto or something that maybe it's a little harder to get to. But the question, bottom line, is it's there. You just need to figure out how to pull it up. It is in the EXIF data.
Yep. It's recorded when you release that shutter button.
Yes, it is.
Or actually when you press it, right?
Real quick, from Ryan Coral in Washington, D.C., he says, I've always been taught to take as many shots as you can. You have a higher chance of getting the great shot. And even then, there's always something in post you can do to make it better. But I read something from a blogging enthusiast photographer say that professionals don't edit 99% of their shots. I find this hard to believe. How often do you edit your shots? Well, I think what he's really – if he's talking about professionals that don't edit, the first thing that comes to my mind, Frederick, is photojournalists because they're not allowed to.
Right. Yeah. Shoot it and upload everything and let people on the back end make the decisions. Right.
Yeah. So that would be who doesn't edit their shots. As for me, I never let anything go to a customer that hasn't been edited. Now,
yes.
I'm because of this conversation, we started the show with Frederick in the days when I shot Velvia film where I had, if I was really lucky, a fifth of a stop either way to be wrong about the exposure.
Yeah.
Because it was slide film and there was no scanner at the time and there was no Photoshop. And I mean, it was the picture was the slide.
Yep.
I still am pretty good at getting it right in the camera. But there's always a little something that's lost in the digital analog conversion. And so, a touch. We have like a 2-minute rule here at my shop. We never spend more than 2 minutes editing a photograph. So I tell my staff, if you've spent more than 2 minutes editing it, it's not the right image.
Yeah. And I think where it's subjective, right? I mean,
sure.
Those are rules for your shop, but that's not people shouldn't say, okay, well, that's the way Scott Bourne does it, so that's the way. That's
absolutely
the rule.
Not. Like, yeah. You could do it the way RC does it, which is 2 hours a picture.
Exactly. Yeah. Some people say, and the metric is time, right? How much time do you have to work on this image? If you have 300 images and you've got 15 minutes to find the right one, you're going to go through them quick, right? And find the right one, get it out, and you're on to the next thing. But if you're a hobbyist or an amateur, which by definition means you're doing it for the love of it, not the money, then you can find an image that's almost there and then go get yourself a glass of wine and turn on some music can go full screen and become an artisan, kind of pulling out the different aspects and the highlights and shadows. And, oh, she, you know, say it's a portrait. She has a hair on her forehead. I'm going to take that off. You can get it perfect, you know, but you have to make the commitment to have the time to do that. And it's situational. It's based on the kind of photography and the kind of photographer you are.
I agree. I mean, for me, because I make my living at this, time is money.
Yeah, exactly.
And
exactly.
I'm paying those kids to sit there behind the aperture wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not paying them to sit there and have fun. I'm paying them to get the job done. So
you don't let them get a glass of wine and turn on some music while they're editing?
They can turn on music as long as it's in headphones, and we do prohibit wine until after hours.
Gotcha.
But we're pretty loose around here. I mean, we have standards. They're very low, but we do have standards. I think, you know, that's the real catch. If you, you know, spend time editing if you've got it and you enjoy it. Some people don't even like that part, you know.
Yep.
If you look,
and there are full services that have sprout up like for wedding photographers. You can send them a CF card with your raw images on it, and they'll send you back edited, beautiful reinterpretations of that imagery that you can sell to your client.
There's a company called Album Epica that you can send them the pictures, and they'll put together an album for you. They'll design a cool wedding album. You don't have to be involved.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at some of the things that, you know, Brisson used to say, he's like, he didn't really care about printing the pictures. For him, it was finding and snapping the shutter, and that was pretty much the end of his passion for it.
Yeah.
He wanted to capture the moment. Whatever but he did afterwards, he didn't really seem to be all that interested.
Yeah.
So you can take – I know people who are just the other way, Frederick. They don't care at all about taking the picture. They just love working on them in post.
Yeah. So yeah, it just depends on what you love, you know, and what you don't love doing, you can find other ways to get it done.
But the right answer to the listener's question is this: edit the way you want to edit and tell everybody else to shove off.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's your deal. So anyway, lots of fun. Hey, Frederick, I'm really glad you came to be on the 100th episode of Photo Focus with me. It's always good to have you around. If you're not on our show, where would you like me to direct our audience to find you?
Well, I am, like you mentioned at the beginning, I'm on that show that you used to do, Scott, back in the day. I am the host of This Week in Photo. You can find us at thisweekinphoto.com, or you can, of course, just search for us on iTunes. We're in there. And that's a really fun show. So I'd love if some of the Photo Focus people would add us as well. And I'm also launched. It's in soft launch now, so don't tell anybody.
Okay. Just and about 350,000 people.
You, me, and 350,000 people. I've been talking about this site for about 3+ years now. And what I wanted to do, Scott, was...
And it hasn't changed a bit.
Yeah, it still hasn't changed. No, I wanted to create... You know, like we discussed in the beginning, my background is in marketing, right? And marketing and photography. So I wanted to find a way to merge these two things together to help other people market their products or services, particularly creative. So I created a marketing school for creatives, and it's called Media Bytes. And it is live and soft launched right now, but you can check it out at Media Bytes with a Y. BYTES.com. And it's a lot of fun. So I would, there's some free content up there that people can sign up for. But I would love it if a Photo Focus listener or two would poke by and give me their comments.
And what's your handle on Twitter, Frederick?
I am just Frederick Van, FREDERICKVAN.
That'll be in the show notes, which will be up shortly after we do get the show online. Be sure to follow Frederick on Twitter. There's 116,700 plus of you following me. There's no reason each and every one of you shouldn't be following Frederick. So there we go. Thanks for being on the show, Frederick. We will be back here in 10 days, as we always are, on the 5th, the 15th, and the 25th of the month. If you have a question for us, send it to photofocus@me.com. Don't forget about the website, photofocus.com, and follow me on Twitter at Scott Bourne, all one word, SCOTTBOURNE. That's it. That's all the time we have for Photo Focus today. And I'm going to leave you the way we have left you the previous 99 shows by admonishing you to go out there and make pictures. Don't just take pictures. We'll see you on the very next episode of Photo Focus.